I'm not sure if I ever in my entire life had a month fly by as quickly as June did, but what can you expect when you're staring a 100-mile beast right in the face? Race week, bam, quickly approached. My man Robert Rhodes, who's an ultra runner from Woodside and ironically took me on my first trail run a few years ago, he actually runs the Trails in Motion Film Festival, but he introduced me to a guy by the name of Miles Smythe. Over the training runs weekend, about a month before the race. Miles, kick-ass film producer. He produced This Is Your Day, which was just an awesome, awesome film that followed around the 2015 Western States. They had Rod Krar in there, who is one of the best ultra runners in the world, ended up winning the race, but it was just so well put together, so well done. Now, the last thing I was thinking about at all leading into my first 100-mile race was having any sort of film crew follow me around to document the experience. Yet, as Miles and I got talking, it just sort of started to make sense for both of us. In the 43 years of existence, there had never been a mainstream athlete to make the transition to competing in the Western States 100 or any other 100-mile race for that matter. Now, I think the big question really at that point was why not? And I figured it would be interesting to explore why not. And if you think about it, and I watch it on a daily basis, so many professional athletes fall victim to obesity, depression, all sorts of personal issues. And you watch these guys and you just wonder if they had an outlet in their life, would it be able to help them? Now, could running be that outlet? I don't know. But I can say that it is something that's been so big in my life that I think about the things that I've done and I think about the mindset that it puts me in. The overall attitude, it's huge. Absolutely huge. So to look deeper into this, which is sort of the idea of what we want to do with this film, it's intriguing. And the other thing is intriguing for me is the thought of being able to compare and contrast Major League Baseball and Ultra Marathon, which obviously seemed two completely different sports, and trust me, they are. But I think underneath all of it, there's some pretty cool comparisons that are probably a lot more psychological than physical, but they really sort of relate to each other. What drew me to the idea, I think more than anything, was an opportunity to explain to the average sports fan what exactly it means to be an ultra runner, what exactly the ultra running community is all about, what it represents, what it stands for. Now, unfortunately, ultra runners, for the most part, they're looked upon as freaks by a lot of people. They're stereotyped as sort of outcast to be running away from whatever problems they may have in their life. And as far as I'm concerned, like, that couldn't be any further from the truth. Ultra runners that I know, they don't run to escape problems. They run to face them head on. They run for that mental clarity that I was talking about. It directly impacts every other aspect in life. A mental clarity that, quite frankly, it allows these runners to live their life on a different level. This is like, think of a Zen-like approach. A peace, a calmness, sort of a focus. That some of these people, and I'm not saying all of them, but a large majority of them, they achieve that Zen-like state through running. More than anything, the best way to describe the ultra community, it's simple. It's a group of people who enjoy running endless amounts of miles. I get that. but they're not afraid to push the limits of what others consider not humanly possible. Well, guess what? Guess who's finding out whether or not it's humanly possible? It's the ultra community. A group of people whose number one priority, and this is the coolest thing about the sport, is to preserve and maintain the trails that they navigate. Think about it this way. What other sport would you see the greatest players, the legends of the sport, prepping the field before the game? Imagine Michael Jordan sweeping a basketball court before the NBA Finals. How about Derek Jeter raking the infield before the World Series? How about Tom Brady sitting on a John Deere mowing the lawn before the Super Bowl? You can't imagine it because it won't happen. It wouldn't happen. But check this out. The Saturday before the race, I was out on the Western States course doing trail work with several other runners. We're clearing and restructuring an entire section of the trail between Red Star Ridge and I think it was Duncan Canyon. Now, the two runners that were leading the trail work just happened to be the two greatest ultra runners in the history of the sport. Two of the greatest, no doubt. Tim Tweetmeyer and Ann Trason. As a matter of fact, every single runner, this is cool, who runs Western States from elite to bottom barrel age grouper is required to do 8 hours of trail work. Otherwise, they're not allowed in the race. So the Western States Trail Service Team, led by Elka Reimer. Now, this lady has dedicated a large portion of her life to this. She has organized several campouts, trail cleanup sessions throughout the course of the year. But think about this. It snows every single year in the Sierra Nevada, all over the Western States Trail. So what happens when you have this massive amount of snowmelt just running on the course, that the course becomes a big mud pit? So to have somebody who takes a charge like Elka, and you, I don't know, because before I was out on the trails, before I was experiencing this, and you know, putting the packing the dirt down, whatever it was, or you take a the big scissor sort of things, and I'm cutting the branches because of all the moisture, there was this huge overgrowth of, it's called white something, a big white and prickly. That's all you need to know. And it sucks, and you don't want it sticking in your skin because it doesn't feel good. I got to experience all of it that day. But without Elka, without her crew, like, this race doesn't happen. So awesome. So awesome to be a part of it. Following that trail cleanup session, I think that was on a Saturday, I headed back to our home in Truckee, where I got in a couple last-minute trail runs, daily sauna sessions. I was over the top on the heat training. Oh, had to be, though. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. And it was by far and away my biggest fear. On Thursday, I met Miles and his film partner, Damien, at Squaw for the flag-raising ceremony at the top of the escarpment. Now, the one thing I wanted to do, and it started with the trail cleanup, but I just want to I wanted to completely immerse myself in the Western States culture, learn as much about the race, the history of the race, the people involved. I wanted to know everything. I wanted to truly understand how and why this specific race is so special, so sought after. And it didn't take long to find the answers. At the flag raising ceremony, there were two members of the Western States family who had recently passed away. And they did this awesome sort of memorial to both of them, Dr. Bob Land and Emeritus Race Director Greg Sunderland. I did not personally know either one of them, but to hear their friends, to hear their colleagues speak about them, showed me just how close the community, the Western States community, is, and even the ultra running community altogether. I also had an opportunity to hike down the mountain with Mo Livermore, who she headed up the ceremony up at the top of the escarpment and is also one of the original founders of the race. And it was just so fun to hear her perspective on how the race has evolved since the infant days. And my one big takeaway, I would say, was that, look, it's way more than a race. This is a family of runners, past and present, that are continuing to do everything in their power to preserve the authenticity. I spent the rest of Thursday with Miles and Damian. We were shooting some running shots along the Truckee River, and actually ended up in the Truckee River. We did some cool shots around Lake Tahoe as well, and then ended up heading to Truckee Thursday that night with the family. Crushed little lobster roll, chocolate-covered bananas, and whatnot. But Miles and Damian, they showed up Friday morning at the house, and we knocked out an extensive interview about ultra running, about baseball, about the similarities, differences, the two worlds. Talked about the much deeper meaning of running, and really like what the two sports have brought to my life and the ultimate effect that they've had on my family as well. Before I knew it, it was like 12:30 in the afternoon, and I still had a half hour to get to check in, but I got a call from another one of my ultra mentors, Jim Richards, who was one of the dudes leading the check-ins, and he calls me at 12:45 going, "You better get here. You got 15 minutes, yada, yada, yada." So obviously hustled up as much as possible, got there like right at one, absolute whirlwind. All the volunteers could not have been nicer, so cool. Many of them from Sacramento. And I actually remember my playing days for the River Cats back in the day. But once I got dialed in, we quickly headed over to the meeting, the race meeting, where I guess you get all the race details and whatnot, and they introduce the elite field of men's and women's runners. Now, one of the runners that was introduced was a guy by the name of Brian Morrison. And I'd done several interviews about my transition from baseball to ultra running. And a common question that has come up in every one of the interviews was, how did I hear about Western States? And I didn't really have the specific answer. Like, I knew I heard about it when I was a kid, but I dismissed it as something that was so incredibly crazy that it was just really difficult for me to even comprehend. I also knew that when I got into triathlon, there was a girl who trained at the same cycling studio that was preparing to do the Western States. And I think at that point, I really comprehended exactly what it was. You know, 100-mile foot race, Squaw Valley to Auburn, and 19,000 feet of elevation, 23,000 feet of descent, rolling through the Sierra Nevada mountains, temperatures at can start in the 30s, reach well over 100 degrees. Get this, think about that. 70-degree differential. Nuts. So I'm putting this all together, and it was almost over a lifetime of hearing about this race. And, of course, if you complete the journey in under 24 hours, the reward is the legendary silver belt buckle that reads 100 miles in one day. Now, I just couldn't pinpoint it. And so here I was, I'm just days away from competing in my first Western States, and I'm reading the program, Runners to Watch, and I read through all the elites, and then I come across number 133, Eric Burns. That's right. I was embarrassed to be on there. It explained my transition from baseball to ultras and mentioned that I had just recently gotten in the sport. But to be on there next to the elite, right? Like, I don't know. It was a little weird, but it was cool. I definitely think it's cool, and it's a unique story. But it was a runner that I came across, the next runner on the list, literally listed right below my name, Brian Morrison. And it talked about how Morrison is coming back for the first time in 10 years since he was leading the race, collapsed three times running around the track, and ultimately crossed the finish line on what they determined to be assistance. He was disqualified from the race. So you're not going to believe this shit. Sit back for a second. The year was 2006. I'm playing baseball for the Arizona Diamondbacks. I am sitting in the locker room at Chase Field in Phoenix when I ran across an article that explained the entire Brian Morrison situation. I remember marveling at the fact that this dude ran 100 miles, had a 20-minute lead on second place, and couldn't make it around the track on his own power. I was sharing the story with whoever was within an earshot, thinking to myself how incredibly impressive of a feat it was, even if the dude did not, quote unquote, officially win the race. Looking back now, there's not a doubt in my mind. I truly learned about the Western States 100 because of Brian Morrison. The ball sack that this guy had, the pain tolerance, the pain threshold that he was able to endure, it was nothing short of heroic. The fact that he put everything he had into the race to complete in utter exhaustion just completely mesmerized me. Now, I may have not known it that day. I know I didn't know it that day because my first thought after hearing that was not, hey, let me go out and run that race. I was in a completely different world at that point in my life. But subconsciously, there's not a doubt in my mind. That was the day I decided my ass was going to do the Western States. Oh, so here I am, 10 years later, to the day, basically. And I was going to get my shot. 10 years later, Brian Morrison returned. Oh, you can't make this stuff up. So cool. When Tim Tweetmeyer announced Morrison's name, he deserved it. He got a bigger ovation than any other runner. Now, obviously, he was emotional, and, you know, after his whole thing was over, he went back and he sat down. This is a huge auditorium, probably at least 1,000 people. And there's 370-something runners plus, you know, everyone's entourage, of course. And ironically, Morrison is sitting with his wife right next to where I was standing. As soon as the meeting commenced, I went straight up to Brian, introduced myself, told him my entire story, following him 10 years ago when I was still playing baseball and how inspirational his effort was. I was telling him, just him giving every last ounce of his energy to reach the finish line, it resonated deep inside me, to the point where I truly believed that it somehow brought me to the start line. Now, he could not have been a more humble, cooler guy. Sometimes in life, I think we're put in certain situations for certain reasons. And without looking too deeply into it, getting too emotional, like I felt like meeting Brian had way more to do with the alignment of our universes than any sort of random chance. Crazy. I rolled back to the house after the little introductory ceremony, whatever, and we had almost the entire crew there. Big pregame meal. My boy Kowalski came in from Arizona. Franz and Jen Dill were there. My mom, my sister Shay, brother-in-law Justin, cousin Amy was there. Jeez, Tara, my wife, three little munchkins. Lance and Kyle were coming in on race day. Now, Tara had prepared it. It's awesome meal. Like, mountain of vegetables, gluten-free pasta. And we're about to eat, and everyone's sort of gathering around this center island. And, you know, quickly, I kind of want to gather everybody up and just thank everyone for being there. And then I was going to have Tara bless the food, and that'd be it. And as I'm looking around, and we're all kind of commencing, and now everyone's holding hands, I felt this overwhelming gratitude just completely pulsate my body. Like, in the process, like, of thanking everyone for coming, I lost it. I broke down. Now, I can't really explain why, other than I felt incredibly, it's like, selfish in a way, because you're looking around, you're thinking, man, like, all these people are here for me. Everyone was there on my behalf to help me chase an individual dream. I was overwhelmed. Completely overwhelmed. But the one thing is that it made me realize how lucky and how blessed I am to have these people in my life, to put together a crew like that to help me through a journey that I was about to embark on. After the dinner, I went and lied down in bed and pretty much just stared at the ceiling with hopes to try to fall asleep at some point between, I guess it was about 8 p.m. when I got into bed. And the wake-up call was for 3, is what I set my alarm for. Now, it was probably around midnight, I'm guessing, when I finally fell asleep. But 3 a.m. rolled around seemingly minutes later when the alarm went off. Now, it wasn't my alarm. It was my wife's alarm. Now, without asking her, she had set it up as a backup. It's a good thing because the phone that I had set my alarm on went dead. I thought I plugged it in. Apparently did not. Completely dead. So, rolled out of the rack. Started off with a big, like, whiff of eucalyptus oil to get the day going. And then Miles and Damien were there. They're obviously trying to capture anything they could on race day in that morning, which was pretty cool. But let them in the door, fired down a yogurt, had a big cup of coffee, crushed a little oatmeal granola combo, banana. And then basically embraced the fact that the next 24 hours would be the most physically and psychologically challenging of my entire life. I lubed up with chafe cream, Tiger Balm, sunscreen, bug spray, and hemp jelly. I think it was in that order too. Fired on a cooling vest, and I got out the door about 4:15. And it was cold. It really was cold that morning. Now I have the cooling vest on. I was shivering on the way over. Now it takes about 25 minutes to get to Squaw, and I realized when we were about halfway there, I'd forgot my watch. I called back to the house, and I had my sister and brother-in-law who had just left. You know, hopefully they were going to be able to go and grab it and get to me before the gun went off. I arrived at Squad about 4:40, and the temperature on my truck at that point read 41 degrees. The first person I saw, and this is where it just continues to get even better. Guess who? Brian Morrison. Gave him a big hug, wished him luck. And I scurried to go get my number, which we had to pick up that morning. Went to the bathroom one last time. I ran into Jim Walmsley. Now, this was one of the pre-race favorites, one of the baddest runners I've ever seen. I ran Lake Sonoma with him. And I looked up at mile. I forget what mile I was at, but this guy was like 10 miles ahead of me, looking like he was going for a little jog in the park. Now, it's incredible to think what adventures would lie ahead for that dude. It was crazy. Now, Walmsley, just sum this up real quick. He led the race by an incredible margin. He was on pace to break the course record. And he somehow lost traction crossing the American River at Ruckachuckee and was floating down the river. It was like a couple hundred yards. He had to get rescued by water safety patrol. But he somehow still recovered and still had a lead and still was well on pace to win the race, and he took a wrong turn, ended up 4 miles off course. So he goes from breaking the course record to not even finishing in the top 10. Now, nonetheless, I think this guy is, without a doubt, one of the best ultra runners in the world, and he proved it. And he's going to be a force to be reckoned with for years to come, I imagine. But I still had about 10 minutes before the race. So I rolled back into the truck. And I had the seat heater pumping. Oh, it felt good. And then bolted for the finish line. It was like 4:55. Just about the same time Justin and Shay arrived with my watch. Got the watch on. Then 5 minutes later, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Boom! Shotgun goes off. So cool. So cool. The run starts with a, it's a, about basically like 2,600 foot climb within the first 4 miles to the top of the escarpment of Squaw. Now, I ran, hiked up a good portion of that climb with Carl Hoagland, who's the editor of Ultra Running Magazine, and his fiance Erica Lindland, who's a badass runner. She finished, I think it was 9th overall last year, and ended up finishing again 10th in the top 10 again this year. And then Scott Dunlap. So three people that I've gotten to know pretty well, and all three have really helped me better understand the intricacies of the sport and just everything that you would need to know about ultra running. Now, eventually, as I'm running with them, I'm like, yeah, all right, enough's enough. And I backed off. My number one goal in that initial climb was not to put out any sort of big effort at all. When I got to the top, the scene was unbelievable, though. There were a slew of people going nuts, cheering, while the sun was rising back behind us over Lake Tahoe. And then there it is, like the entire Western States course right in front. Took a minute, captured a little video, and then began the trek through the high country over to Lions Ridge, which was the first aid station. So it was, geez, I guess about 10 and a half miles from the start. We rolled into Lions Ridge, and I mean, really, at that point, it felt great. I figured I'd be in trouble if I didn't. The views in the high country, just awesome. Awesome. And one of the shocks to me was the snow. A lot of the snow had melted, and the trail was very smooth, very easy running. And then I'd say after the Red Star aid station, which was, I imagine, somewhere around mile 16, I had broken away from a pack of runners that I was with, but by no means was I, you know, up front, and I just kind of found like a little pocket, and I was running by myself, and I began to open it up a little bit on some slight downhills, and there was a point probably around mile 20 where I completely hit like this running bliss. I'd say a bliss or a time. So I'm there, and I got this huge canyon to my right and a huge canyon to my left with this gorgeous, like, crystal blue shining lake. I was floating, absolutely floating. And just as I was becoming comfortable in this euphoric la-la fantasy running land that I was living in, I clipped my right toe. On, I had to have been a rock or tree branch, whatever, didn't matter. Throughout the course of my major league career, I'll say this, I became known for making diving catches and sort of resembled Superman flying through the air. And I would, instead of just like jumping out, like I would jump up for whatever reason. And I think this situation here was not any different. I literally launched off my feet, went flying through the air. I was heading to the right side of the trail, and I landed in this big ass bush, and the branches of the bush kept me suspended without ever hitting the ground. I was just happy I was alive. That was it. I had a cut on my knee. I'd sliced my shin open. And there was a little blood. It wasn't like a gushing sort of blood. So I was good, but it was like just normal check. Like, okay, hands, yeah, arms still attached, legs still attached. Immediately got my ass up and got right back into the groove. Now, as I headed down to Duncan Canyon aid station, there was a section that was just completely exposed. And at this point, we're dropping altitude too. So as we're making our way down, the temperature was increasing by the minute. Duncan Canyon, I believe, was about mile 25-ish. And for whatever reason, I don't know if it was the heat or lack of calories, I just felt like shit. I iced up for the first time, put ice in the arm sleeves. I got some watermelon, some salt in me, crushed a PB&J. And I was on my way, but the next mile after the aid station, terrible. Overall, it's downhill, and it's pretty easy terrain, but there are a few mile ascents that I should have had no problem running. Yet, dude, I was nauseous, not feeling good. And those little tiny speed bumps brought me to like a slow walk on the easiest of uphills. So here I was at mile 25, already walking. And I'm looking ahead thinking, if I'm doing this at mile 25, what am I going to be doing at mile 75? I knew that in order to break 24 hours, I would say if there's a general rule on this, and I'd never done the race before, but from people I talked to and everything, you gotta run the flats, you gotta run the downhills, and you power hike the uphills. Pretty easy formula. But if all of a sudden here I am this early in the race, walking the most minuscule of uphills, it wasn't good. I took my time, relaxed, made it down to the river. And when I got down there, I let my feet soak a little bit in the cold water. Just did my best to get my shit together. Pulled out the cell phone, took a little video. Now, I started the race in my Salomon S-Lab speed shoes. They're light, durable, fast, most water-resistant shoes I'd ever put on. I ran 62 miles at Miwok in the pouring-ass rain and had absolutely no issues. And I was not afraid to get my shoes wet at all. Now, at this point, you know, I thought it was a benefit of wearing those things is I knew they could survive the water. And an opportunity to go through a creek and get in the water and cool off the feet was big. But I made the long hike up to Robinson Flat, and I was trailing three elite female runners. I figured I was in good company because Erica Lindlin was leading the charge, and she ended up finishing ninth overall. But when I ended up at Robinson, I felt better. I felt a lot better. Tara and the crew was there for the first time, got my water bottles replaced. Then I added a couple more. In total, I was now carrying four Salomon soft last bottles. And as I headed into the hottest part of the race, I was good with that. I didn't care if it was over the top, whatever, but I was totally good with being, I don't know, whatever you call it, like, overly prepared than underprepared, having to hit that heat. I had two of the bottles were strapped to the back of my hands. I think sort of spider hand gimmick things that I actually love. And then the two other ones I would hold. So I had two on the back of my hands and then two that I was holding, which I froze the night before. So as I'm holding on to them, they're also acting as some sort of coolant, at least, to the palm of my hand. And then the baseball sanitary sock. That's right. Fill that bad boy up with ice. So instead of using a bandana around the neck, the baseball sanitary sock was my gear choice. And I filled it up with ice and then wrapped it around the neck, easy to tie. Oh, savior. Miller's Defeat was next in Dusty Corners, where my sister was there and my brother. So it was like crew two. And saw them. They had another fresh sanitary sock waiting for me filled with ice. And then Last Chance was the name that I think is just perfect. How about the just iconic and epic names all the way along the Western States course? But Last Chance was, that was exactly what it says it is. The Last Chance. I literally, you want to refuel? Last chance. You want to recharge? Last chance. You want to find a way to cool down? Last chance. You are about to hit the absolute depths of the canyon and then make the climb up the Devil's Thumb. So the Last Chance aid crew station was awesome. Snapped another video upon the exit, then was on my way to thumb wrestle the devil. Now, I've always struggled in heat every single race I have ever done since entering the endurance world. By far and away, my biggest concern of the entire race was how I was going to be able to manage the scorching hot weather in the canyons. Now, the thought of using the baseball sanitary sock filled with ice, it came to me from watching just pictures, years of it. They would fill a sanitary sock up with ice and then wrap it around their arm. Now, the socks are really light. They're durable. It's very easy to tie and keep tight from both sides. The only time I actually tried it, though, was in the sauna a few days before, and it worked perfect then, and it worked even better on the course. I could not make an argument. I take that back. I can make an argument that the baseball sanitary sock saved my race. Despite consistent temperatures in the 90s that climbed well into the hundreds, I gotta believe, in certain part of the canyons, I never once through the course of the entire race felt overwhelmed by the heat. Bit ironic that a piece of baseball equipment may have completely saved my 100-mile endurance debut. Crazy. Once I got to the bottom of the canyon and began climbing up Devil's Thumb, I was noticing some weird shit. There was somebody on my ass running right behind me, but every time I turned around and went to let this dude pass, like, he was gone. Then there was a guy that was, like, positioned about halfway up the climb. He was in the bushes, he was on a knee, he was taking pictures, huge extended camera lens. Yet, every time I got closer to the cameraman, guess what? He was gone. Also along the course, throughout the canyons, I kept seeing a woman. Enthusiastic older lady. She was actually clapping and cheering, dropping words of encouragement. When I got closer, wanted to thank her for her support, right? Guess what? She was gone. I also kept hearing this constant ruffling in the bushes. I was certain I was getting stalked by a mountain lion. I would slow down and kind of swiftly turn to my right, turn to my left, whatever. And every time when I did, the noise stopped. It was gone. Oh, it was weird. I've got to say, it was the ice that when I had the ice on the neck, it would make the noise. So that one's explainable, right? Because you're hearing things as you're running, and the ice is making noise. And so the feeling of getting stalked by the mountain lion or stalked by something in the bush, it made sense the way it would, maybe the noise would echo through the canyon. As far as the other stuff, and the baby cub that I saw off to my right, but obviously once again as I got closer, it was gone too. I finally realized, I'm like, look, my vision's fucking with me. Like, this is, it's playing, my mind's playing tricks. It ended with an orangutan. I'm not kidding. An orangutan. Like, I'm looking up at a tree branch, and I'm thinking to myself, I said, there was an orangutan swinging from the tree. No joke. And, of course, as I approach, and this is, like, towards the top of Michigan Bluff, it's, like, two tree branches. So I'm having these hallucinations that, I don't know if you call them hallucinations, because I'm actually was looking at objects and the objects just appeared to be something else. And then as I got closer, the objects were just the objects that they were, be it a tree stump or a bush with a stump right by it. I mean, it was, regardless, it was obviously a trip. And I'm not an expert on hallucinations, but I got to imagine that's something to do with the heat, fatigue, maybe my kick-ass old school blue blocker sunglasses. I don't know. I have no, somebody help. Somebody let me know and let me know it's semi-normal. But somehow survived it. And it wasn't later in the race either. And it was that point. It wasn't like later in the race I was experiencing these things as well. When I arrived in Michigan Bluff after two of the gnarliest climbs of the day, my watcher had 59 miles. I knew that Forest Hill was at mile 62. So I figured just 3 miles ago until the next aid station where I'd be able to see the entire crew. Now, when I rolled into Michigan Bluff, I kept thinking how weird it was that the two crew aid stations, you know, pretty big crew aid stations, were only 3 miles apart. Now, I took this minimalist approach when I got to Michigan Bluff, dropped a couple water bottles, done carrying around four, slammed a Coke, and I wanted to take off. I was gone. I was going to get all my refueling done at Forest Hill. Then Jen Dill, Franz's wife, is like, Eric, like, no, like, you got to eat more. Yeah. I'm like, Jen, it's only 3 miles away. It's Forest Hill. She's like, Eric, Forest Hill is 7 miles away, not three. Basically, I just felt like I got kicked in the nuts. I know it's only 3 miles that I was off here. But when you think you're at 59 and you're really at 56, it's a downer. No doubt it's a downer. I was in out on this like desolate road in between Michigan Bluff and Forest Hill, and I'm all by myself. Nobody's within sight either direction. And I heard footsteps like rapidly coming up behind me. And I figured once again, here I am just hallucinating, whatever else. And I didn't really bother to turn around. Then I kept hearing the footsteps and getting closer. And now I'm hearing heavy breathing. I'm like, okay, this is weird. And I finally turn around. And from behind me is this furry, four-legged little creature that I presume to be a dog running at like Mach 3 full speed up the hill, flies right by me, and then he's gone. I began just uncontrollably laughing. So here I was, somewhere between mile 56 and 60, or whatever. I had no idea exactly where I was. But I'm feeling sorry for myself. And here comes this dog that looked like the most pure and natural runner I think I'd ever seen in my life. And he didn't give a shit about what zone he was running in. He didn't care how hot it was or what reading on his GPS watch was. This little guy's out there running for what? The simple and pure joy for the sport. Well, guess what? What do you think I was out there running for? What do you think every other freaking runner that decided I'm going to run 100 miles was out there for? The same fucking thing. The exact same thing. The simple, pure joy of this sport. And as I'm going through this and analyzing this in my mind, and I fully comprehend the parallels, I could not take a smile off my face. That was it. I mean, I was just like, yes. Yes, yes, yes. When I was making my way out of Volcano Canyon, I saw Miles. He was waiting for me, and he was awesome the whole day. I mean, while I'm talking, we get near an aid station, and this guy was popping up like mile and a half, 2 miles away from the aid, just out of nowhere, in bushes. And maybe that's part of the reason why I was having all those hallucinations. Half the time, it was just Miles out there, still not positive, but he told me, he's like, hey, dude, all your boys are waiting up top. Go get them. And that was music to my ears. I didn't think I was going to see him till Forest Hill, yet apparently they were waiting at Bath Road. Now, speaking of music, by the way, I started this race with wireless headphones in my pocket, and I was now approaching mile 60 at this point, and I had yet to take the headphones out. Now, I didn't necessarily plan to listen to music, but I did not plan not to listen to music. And the bottom line was, I was so involved in each and every moment and dynamic of that race that I didn't need it. Did not need that. Try explaining that to your friends, because I guess it was tough for them to understand. But I just, man, something about being out on that trails. Waiting at Bath Road, Pacer Dream Squad, leader of the Bobby Malibu Overachievers Multi-Sport Life Optimization Group, Michael Kowalski. He was there. Oh, I have a lid I rock all the time. And people ask me what it is. It has that phrase on, Bobby Malibu Overachiever Multi-Sport Life Optimization Group. And basically, it's exactly how it reads, except for the name Bobby Malibu, which is a spin-off of an old iconic American Gladiator character, which absolutely has no affiliation with the group or anything else, just our sort of legendary humorous team mascot. The next dude who was waiting was, my original Facebook stalker and sort of endurance sports mentor, San Rafael firefighter, Kyle Hamilton. Also waiting was Franz Dill, who was a four-time Western States finisher, did the Grand Slam in 2011, and he was going to be my official pacer from 80 to 100. He's my neighbor in Half Moon Bay. And then last, certainly not least, and I think without a doubt, our most controversial member, seven-time Tour de France champion, amateur ultra runner, WeDo founder, and typical adrenaline junkie who fits in perfectly with the rest of the Pacer Dream Squad, Lance Armstrong. Stud. The entire 2-3 mile section that I got to run with everybody, the whole squad, was one of the most, not one of the most, it was without a doubt the most invigorating section of the race. We talked, I don't know, whatever, gear, strategy, nutrition, fluids, energy consumption. It didn't matter. You know, we talked bullshit and a whole lot of it. And just to have those dudes around, BSing, yappity yap, there's an energy that it brings to you that is awesome. Myla, who we call her My My, she's Tara's my good friend from Arizona. She joined us as well, too. Once we got to Forest Hill. And the Forest Hill is by far and away, it's the biggest aid station and one of the few points of the race where it's an absolute spectacle with people lining the street on both sides. It's about a mile stretch. And as we made our way down the, let's call it the parade chute, people were going nuts. And I actually just got the chills thinking about it. The euphoric feeling that I had as we were marching down together, a squad, six deep. So cool. And it wasn't about me. And that's the greatest thing. I've never been great at individual sports. I've always been better at team sports. And as much as this is an individual sport, when you can get surrounded with a team, like that's what draws me to this. That's what makes me love this. It was so cool. Team Apo Taco is what my wife called us. We're unified. We're together. That's what this sport's about. I'll tell you what, one of the most rewarding sights, too, by the way, the entire day, was when I saw John Trent, 10-time finisher, former Western States president. He was out there at Forest Hill and cheering loudly for our group as we rolled through town. So cool to see. When we met up with the rest of the crew, they're all the way down at the end, almost all the way by Cal Street. A few of the realities, I think, began to set back in. First and foremost, my feet were freaking wrecked. The crew wanted me to change shoes and socks, but I knew that we had a big river crossing at mile 78. And the only other shoes that I wanted to change into were the Hokas. And I only had one pair of Hokas. And softly cushioned. Those are the shoes I wanted to bring me home, right? And I know how rocky that last section could be too. So to change into those shoes at that point and then go through the mild, you know, the Rucky Chucky river crossing at mile 78 and running on the waterlogged, I mean, that just sounded even worse. So I did not change. I did, however, try to pound a In-N-Out double-double. Which didn't go all that well. Some fries spit up half of it, and Lance and I took off. Now, Lance, about a mile into it, is like, hey, man, do you hear something? And I'm kind of looking at him, something? Yeah, maybe. And he's like, hi, stop. And we both look at each other, kind of shrug. I'm like, yeah, I hear something. I don't know, whatever. What are we supposed to do? We're on course. Here's yellow ribbons. And then finally, we get about almost like 2 miles away from Forest Hill. And from behind us comes my brother-in-law flying. He's like, dude, you forgot your light. That's a good brother-in-law right there. Solid brother-in-law. He was right. I'd forgotten my light. Lance had his. I never grabbed mine, but forgot it at Forest Hill. From mile 60 to 80, there's not a doubt in my mind, I could not have asked for a better pacer. Lance and I bullshitted the entire time. We talked life, cycling, baseball, family, just about everything you could imagine. Nothing was off the table. In all, I'm guessing there's probably about 2 minutes of dead air in our 4 hours of running together. Now, you guys have to understand, like, break Lance out of his hard shell that he can appear to have at times. This dude is, not only is he fun to hang with, he's got a freaking enormous heart. Really, really, really good heart. made some dumbass decisions along the way, as we all have. But what's awesome to see is the inner beauty that he has. By the time we rolled into the last aid station before the river, I think it was about mile 73, we'd absolutely hit our stride. I had felt as good as I had all day. Sun was down, darkness was starting to settle in, so obviously not nearly as hot. And the dude greeted us at the aid station, even calling, he's like, "Man, you guys look good." Now, unfortunately, he followed up with, "Just sink. All you got left is a marathon." Don't ask guys to start thinking at mile 73, because I become overly consumed with the fact that I still had a marathon to go. Not just your average street marathon, but 26.2 miles over incredibly rocky, unstable terrain through a roaring river. And then, of course, up and down at least several thousand more feet. Fuck. Oh, man. Before we bolted, though, I had one of the more unusual requests of the day. I needed a hair tie. Now, I had taken my cooling skull cap off from under my hat because I was no longer hot enough, or, you know, wasn't worth wetting and putting ice in it, and I was just done with it. Yet, I could still feel as I was running, like, the only part of my body I felt like it was trapping in heat, like, was my head. So, I wanted to ditch the hat, but my hair is so long on top that, like, my bangs will fall on my face without something to tie it up. Hence, I got the little mini man bun. There were three women there. Not one of them had a hair tie. Then out of nowhere, this big, burly cowboy dude rolls up. He's like, "Boy, you need a hair tie?" I'm like, "Yes, sir." He then proceeds. He reaches into his pocket. He's like, "I got three. Which color would you like? Purple, pink, or black?" Oh, I was laughing. I'm like, "Dude, I don't care. Whatever." I'd say I'm probably not much of a purple or pink guy, but I'm in. You want to give it to me? I'm all in. Much like the pioneers who blazed the Western States Trail, you never know where you're going to strike gold. Quickly tied the hair knot, and the Man Pony Express was off. We had one big last climb, then it was a dash towards the lights. Such a cool sight of the historic river crossing at Rucky-Chucky. When we got there, we refueled. There's an aid station on the near side of the river. And then we made our way down, probably about 40 yards to the middle fork of the American River. And because of the massive amount of snowfall that we got this winter, the water level of the river is higher and flowing much better than in years past. So just actually, they actually put a cable that starts on the near side. It stretches all the way across the river. And the runners had to hold on to the cable as they navigated their way through the chest-high water across these slippery rocks and boulders. And it was just so awesome to have the volunteers there. And they came up huge once again. They fired life vests on both Lance and I. And there was a team, at least 10 to 12 people, that were staged in the water along the path of the cable. Now, I grew up surfing in Half Moon Bay, where the ocean water typically hovers in the low 50s. I mean, cold water, for the most part, doesn't bother me. I don't know what the temperature of the American River was at that point of the night, but I can say from experience, it was freaking bone-chilling. Maybe it was the heat earlier in the day. I have no idea. But I stepped in that thing, and it was... When we got to the other side, I was shocked, too, to see the entire crew waiting at the bottom. I didn't think we were going to be able to see them until we got to the top of Green Gate, which is like a two-mile hike. So here we were, the whole crew together, everybody, making the two-mile hike up to Green Gate. And we're rolling, what, 10-plus deep, shoulder to shoulder, just BSing about everything that had taken place. And we also had a chance to strategize about the last 20 miles. Now, my feet were toast. They were toast at mile 62, so obviously we weren't getting much better. And we had to figure out a way to get them through the last 20. Now, everyone was telling me, change your shoes, change your socks. The thought of taking off my socks and exposing my dogs at that point, like, gut-wrenching. I knew my feet were slaughtered, but I wanted to deal with them after the race. I also knew that exposing them was going to freak everybody out, almost to the point where they probably wouldn't even want me to continue. When we got to the top, I flew through the aid station, went and sat down for the first time all race. First time was at mile 80. How? This is interesting. How was Franz's buddy and his crew guru in many of his ultras that he's done? And I met Howe for the first time that morning. Now here we were several hours later, 80 miles into the Western States 100, and Howe is peeling off my compression socks and like pedicuring my feet that looked like they just went through a meat grinder. I mean, was this dude dropped from the heavens or what? Originally, Franz was going to pace me from mile 60 to 80. And Lance was going to go from 80 to 100. We eventually decided to switch it up last minute. And that was, without a doubt, the right decision. Figuring Lance and I were both relatively unfamiliar with the course, it would be so much better for us to run in as much light as possible, which we did. And as far as Franz, this dude could basically run the trail backwards, blindfolded, with one leg tied behind his back. He knows this course as well, if not better, than anybody affiliated with the race. So Franz and I shot out of Green Gate totally invigorated. And as we made our way toward the mile 85 Auburn Lakes Trail aid station, we sort of hit this happy place. And it didn't take long to realize how incredible of knowledge that Franz had with the terrain. We'd be coming up on a section, Franz would say, we have about 400 feet of technical rocky descent coming up. Watch your step and take it easy. We then go around the next bend. Franz jumps in again. We have a slight downhill of nice hard-packed dirt. We can open it up a little bit. Then shortly before the next section, which just happens to be an uphill, we'll say, well, we have about a two-minute climb coming up. Good time to take in your fluids and get some it was like a tour guide. He was fantastic. Fantastic. I have not been in the sport very long, and I'm not sure what constitutes a great pacer, but I got to say, between Lance and Franz, I could not have asked for two better dudes. Running with Lance was like going on a jog with a buddy. There was no doubt that we opened it up, we pushed the pace, but Lance's greatest asset was that he kept me entertained the whole time. BS conversations, good stories. Franz, a tour guide, a technician, an engineer on the course. He knew absolutely every turn, every descent, every ascent, well before we ever approached it. As soon as Franz and I got rolling, mile 80, here's the other thing. My headlamp, dying, done, fast. I figure I was screwed. Franz quickly pulled out of nowhere, of course. It has the backup light. Pulls out a handheld. Proceeded to shoot the light in front of me on the trails at an angle. Now, it was better than I could have ever lit the course myself. I've joked around about the Pacer Dream Squad and this, that. Hey, this was no joke. No joke at all. Between the crew, Lance, Franz, whatever, with Pacer Dream Squad, 100%. Auburn Lake Trails aid station, it's run by the Coastside Running Club. Franz just happened to be the president of the Coastside Runners Club, by the way. And when we were approaching the aid, Franz lets out his signature howl call. Ho! Whatever it is. And immediately the Coastsiders are howling back like a pack of wolves. Now, Franz, his wife Jan, and the rest of the Coastsiders, they run by far and away the best aid station at Miwok. By far and away. And Western States, I mean, why would I expect anything different? They have this Christmas-themed thing going on. So starting about a quarter mile away was like this plethora of like green and red lights. And I mean, I felt like I was walking in Central Park on December 24th. All the volunteers were dressed up in Christmas themed garb, and they basically delivered like Santa Claus too. Outside of the normal aid station fixings, which I'd grown accustomed to at that point, 85 miles into the race, the Coastsiders, they're flipping bacon and eggs on the griddle. It's crazy. As tempting as it was to sit down and have this full diner breakfast, Franz sort of kept me on schedule. Walloped down chicken broth, a Coke, and we were gone. That was now my go-to. Chicken broth, Coke, get another thing of the gel block things, and voila. Now, at this point, we were about 50 minutes up on the 24-hour pace. Between mile 85 and 90, there was very little interaction between Franz and I. We both knew my main goal was to finish in under 24 hours. It now looked like so long as I could stay on my 2 feet, that was going to happen. Now, of course, Franz and I both knew as we were approaching that 23-hour mark what that meant. 24 hours was no longer the goal. Finishing in the 22 as was. So we rolled up to Brown's Bar at mile 90, and you could hear this aid station from nearly a mile away. It sounded like we were in a 1980s hair band club with AC/DC and Metallica headlining. We're in and out in a hurry, though. And at that point, we were a few minutes behind the 23-hour mark. But we just continued to hammer the pace. And at no point in the entire race had my effort level been as high as it was, I'd say probably between mile 90 and 94. We're doing everything in our power. Everything in our power. The last thing we wanted to do was have to make some sort of sprint to the finish on the track in Auburn to break 23 hours. So we were trying to get ahead of the pace. Now, before we reached Highway 49, apparently Franz had texted the crew, and that's where we were going to be able to see him, our new goal. And he basically, I guess he instructed him to keep the pit stop to a minimum. And according to everyone in the crew at 49 aid station, they were saying I appeared a bit loopy. I guess I asked my brother-in-law where the babies were, and it was 2:30 in the morning. And I dispute this one, but my wife said that I called my mom Juju Pants. I don't believe it. Do not believe it. We bolted out of there, and we were right on the 23-hour pace, but it was on. We were moving. We power hiked the first hill, and then we busted our asses on the flats, downhills that took us to No Hands Bridge. And I would love to sort of give you a more detailed account of the section, but to be honest, I don't really remember it all that well. When we got to No Hands Bridge at mile 97, we had just over 3 miles to the finish. We basically blew through the aid station, completely blew through the aid station. And now we're running uphill sections that I undoubtedly would have been walking earlier in the race. We got to a point where there was a turn that went up to the right. And there was another one that sort of continued forward. And there were two runners that had stopped, and they had no idea which way to go because there was no visible ribbon in place. And of course, Franz to the rescue without hesitation. He's like, "This way, boys." We finished the climb up to Roby Point, exerting really as much energy as possible. And then we got the famous mile 99 sign where Tara was there, Shay was there, Justin, Mila, Kowalski, Kyle. I mean, it was surreal. And they were all there waiting to charge the final mile together. I looked at the clock for the first time and realized that we had about 20 minutes to get through that last 1.2 miles. I then told the runners who were behind us to go ahead so they didn't have to share the track with the Oppo Taco Small Army. And I'd say after that, proceeded to run the most rewarding mile of my entire life. Whatever pain I had felt over the course of the first 99 miles is gone. I was giddy. Running the last mile of the oldest and most prestigious 100-mile race in the world with the most important people in my life. When I reached the track, my mom and kids were waiting there to run as well. Now, Callie and Colton, Callie just turned 6, Colton's 4. They were both tired. I mean, you got to imagine they were sleepwalking. And I'm not sure exactly if they comprehended everything that was going on. But I pull off the track and like on the grass to try to get Callie to run because she really wasn't having it. And she's like, "I don't want to run." So I tried to carry her. She wasn't into it. But we continue to make our way around the track. And I told everybody in the crew that I wanted nothing more. I wanted everyone across the finish line together. and the entire crew was there. Like, here we are running like shoulder to shoulder until we hit the last straightaway, and all of a sudden, boom, everyone peels off. Now, you got to understand this. The reason why I would want everyone in the entire crew to cross the finish line together is because this is a crew effort. Without them, I don't complete the 100.2 miles. Over 19,000 feet of elevation gain, 23,000 feet of descent. It's like a NASCAR team. Like, this is real. This was as much of a team effort as you could possibly imagine and dream of. And I wanted to cross with the team. Now, all of a sudden, boom, they're gone. My mom had walked across the infield, though. So now she was there, and Callie was back there, and Colton was there. So I pull my mom on the track, and Chloe, my 7-year-old, she comes sprinting out of nowhere. And then Tara had Colton and Callie from they came, I guess, from behind us. Now, my sister had passed me the Pat Tillman jersey, which I hoisted above my head. And then we got to, I'd say, probably about 90 feet. I was running with Chloe, and I'm kind of looking back at my mom to, hey, hurry up, let's go. And we get to that last 90 feet. And I think I just got this impulse. Maybe it was Tropical John on the mic that said, oh, just about 90 feet to go here, Eric. I think you got this. And I made a sprint for the finish. Just bolted. 22 hours and 50 minutes, 55 seconds after the day had begun at Squaw Valley. I crossed the finish line at Placer High School of the Western States 100-mile endurance run. I played 11 seasons of Major League Baseball. I've completed 8 Ironmans, multiple ultramarathons. There is not a doubt that the Western States 100 was the most difficult, grueling, rewarding, and humbling thing I have ever done in my life. I finished 73rd overall. I was one of 102 silver belt buckle winners who finished in under 24 hours. There are no words I can speak or emotions I can express that will show the gratitude that I have for my entire family, my entire group of friends that helped me throughout that journey. I don't think there's a doubt that a common theme with the Western States 100 is realizing the value of paying it forward. Passing it on. Giving the next person the opportunity to experience the exhilaration of trail running. I have and will continue to champion Pat Tillman and the foundation that bears his name in hopes of teaching the future generation about who Pat was and the ultimate sacrifice that he made for something that he deemed much larger than himself, to take his jersey and throw it above my head just like I have for every one of my Ironman races. As I cross the finish line of the Western States 100 to hopefully impact one person, if there's one person that sees the video, if there's one person that happened to be sitting there in the stands at 3:50 in the morning and said, Mommy, Daddy, why is he carrying that jersey? That's what life's about. That's what this is about. As far as my own pursuits, like, look, I work in a job where I have a very rare opportunity to influence kids to play baseball and live life with an effort and passion that ideally will hopefully inspire future generations. I hope, though, I really hope that people of all ages realize the physical and psychological value of exercise, of getting out there and doing something, making a difference. I hope to inspire anyone who has been diagnosed with ADD, just as I was in the third grade, and I was prescribed coffee back in the mid-80s, modern-day Adderall, I guess, that there is an outlet, there's a focus that is obtainable that will allow your children, that will allow you to thrive in a classroom, at home, at the office, whatever. Whatever sports you choose. There is a place to find your zen. And I promise you, so long as you can physically get out there and run, do it. I get it. Doing Ironmans, running 100 miles, it's not for everybody. I understand. Some people, hey, maybe you don't have the time to dedicate the training hours involved. Yet, I'll say this, if you are willing to commit to the training demands, there is not a doubt in my mind that that person has the ability to complete whatever his or her mind is able to dream up. The question simply becomes, are you willing to pay the price? I could hear a lot of you saying no right now. I get it. Are you willing to make the necessary sacrifices in order to achieve your dreams? Maybe. Maybe not. But it doesn't have to be 100 miles. It doesn't have to be an Ironman. Get out there and do it. The next day after I completed Western States, Callie, my 6-year-old daughter, who wanted nothing to do with the final lap around the track before crossing. And I was thinking to myself, how long will it be until this resonates with her? How long do I think it will be until she fully comprehends it? I don't know. And will she ever? I don't know. I can't guarantee that. But here I was, laid up on the couch, downstairs, and guess who comes rolling in, sits on my lap, wraps her hands around my neck, and says, Daddy, guess what? When I turn 40, I am going to run the Western States 100, and you can pace me. Oh, I was speechless. And again, I obviously, this emotional sort of experience and time and whatever, and it's like immediately I had a tear gun in my eye. Even when your children may seem uninterested, realize that they're always watching. Your influence as a parent, even if you're not a parent, a mentor, it's far greater than you will ever know. It is our responsibility as people in a position to influence, to instill values, work ethics, beliefs, that there are no limits. There are no limits as to what is attainable. Live your life like your kids are watching. Live your life like somebody else's kids are watching. 10 years ago, there was a dude that drove himself to complete exhaustion trying to win a race. Ultimately, he was disqualified. 10 years later, Brian Morrison officially crossed the finish line of the Western States 100. Guess what? Carrying his own two children. 43 years ago, there's a man who lined up on foot next to a plethora of horses in a horse race. And this dude had the idea that he was going to run 100 miles in a 24-hour period. People back then thought he was completely nuts. That man, Gordy Ainslay, who a lot of people still think is completely nuts, not only completed the quest 43 years ago, but he became responsible for the creation of modern-day ultra running. Once again, just as he had practically done every year since, Gordy stepped up to the start line. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Question is, what are you going to do with your next 43 years? Dream big.